Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to HedgEye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our HedgEye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Day two of the summit. You know, that music, we try to play that music when we start talking seriously about bonds. So George Goncalves is with us today. First time on HedgEye TV. I'm excited, as always, to have somebody new on. It's new content, George, your new content. I appreciate you taking the time to have the conversation.
No, thanks for having me on St. Paddy's Day, on Fed Day of all days. So it's going to be a good run, hopefully.
Yeah, you got to deal with an Irish guy on St. Paddy's Day. And I haven't started drinking yet, so that's all right.
It's 11 o'clock. It's 11 o'clock on the East Coast. Come on.
You know, if I wasn't doing this, I might be doing that. But, it's an amazing thing. Now everybody is a bond market expert, of course, and how interest rates are going to go from here and what's going to happen, this, that, and the other. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. Of course, most people are anchored with their equity market strategies and views, and then they find their way to us on this front. So I think that this is going to be really educational for people to see how you think about your process. So maybe let's start with that. I definitely want to get into, like on slide four of your presentation, your process in particular, and really dig into that so that people have a framework. But maybe a little bit about yourself and how you went out on your own first.
Yeah, sure. So, Keith, I've been in the markets for over 20 plus years. Prior to where I'm at now, I was the head of strategy, where I formerly ran the fixed income strategy group at the at Nomura Securities, and I've held various positions along the way at the large broker dealers. And, really started off my career in Mother Merrill back in, the old Merrill back in the late 90s, focused on the short-term rate markets, the plumbing of the system. I was part of a short-term money markets fund desk. And it really starting in the late 90s, where I experienced the Asia financial crisis, long-term capital management. And in many ways, if you think about it, that's really the kind of the starting point where we all at least the people in the bond market start to really realize that we were leveraged to liquidity in a very big way, and that the repo chains and the collateral system played such a big role on how the financial system was yet to still evolve, but it was evolving very quickly. And so, really that was a great starting point for my career. I was always interested in systems and how things come together. And so I kind of stuck along that path, went through various research positions along the way. And most recently, since my gig on the street and as a response to the pandemic, I've been building out my own kind of platform, looking for the right platform to really deliver an easy way to consume fixed income, both global macro content, but also what are the metrics that I look at? How do I determine fair value? The idea of mean reversion is so grounded in fixed income, and it's something that sometimes that it gets lost among some of the equity investors. And so I've been trying to serve as that kind of bridge and share whatever I can.
So let's it's great. I mean, it's always, to me, it's always an interesting journey that we all have, particularly once you get into the 20, 30 year range. And it makes us a little, in my case, a little fatter on this St. Paddy's Day and a little more weathered. And here we are. But it really, you find yourself at a place where you're still learning a lot. It seems like when I see, again, I've only met you on Twitter, but I mean, it seems like you're that type of person, constantly reimagining, re-educating yourself on both your process and what the hell's going on. Is that a fair take?
100%. And maybe if you want to turn to slide four, and we can kind of just at least have that up and running. I mean, so fixed income in general is rooted in quantitative methods. And so we are very much very mathematically inclined. And you need to do that in order to study the cash flows, understand duration, convexity, and then tie it all back to what the fundamentals are doing, what central banks are telling us. But I'll be honest, I'm sure we'll get through it, through the course of our conversation. We've had multiple regimes. And although, especially in the last 20, 30 years, where we went from a disinflationary type environment, globalization, you know, to the pinnacle of off balance sheet shadow banking, which almost took down the whole thing in 07 and 08, to, you know, a central bank dominated world where now the last 10 plus years, no one knows anything different than other just what's your view on the Fed or ECB. But I show, you know, on this slide here on slide four, that absolutely it's an iterative process. You have to continue to keep learning. You know, the old models that you had don't necessarily work in the same sort of regime. You have to do a lot of like scenario analysis. And so I kind of like look at it as like, you know, these four pillars around a really global macro fundamentals view, where, you know, you have to kind of have your own view. And in many ways, I mean, I've seen what you guys do around your growth, inflation, and policy, your GIP. It's, you know, bond folks think like that naturally. We're kind of naturally inclined that way. So, you know, we're global macro by nature. And then, you know, looking at what that means relative to the metrics that we developed to kind of look for value, as well as extremes in the markets, try to see if you want to kind of take the other side. And, you know, also, at least in the U.S. fixed income markets, we're really afforded a lot of good data around, you know, both sentiment as well as, you know, positioning and flows. And so if you can kind of bring those four things together, you can form a pretty educated view that is both, you know, I consider myself like a quant slash, you know, qualitative hybrid of an amalgamation of all this data, as well as my experience over the years of trying to understand what it all means.
Well, that data in and of itself, I had a great conversation yesterday at the summit here with Mike Green. And, you know, just the evolution of how we quantify in and of itself is such an obvious subject matter. But maybe if you give people, like, color that up a bit and give people an example. Like, what was George's life like literally 15 to 20 years ago and the machines and data that he had then versus what he has now? And how has, you know, the business changed in terms of bond market analytics?
Sure. I mean, look, so I think back in the day, we're still using it. Back in the day, right? Back in the day, being like, you know, the 90s, many of us were still learning how to use the Bloomberg terminal. So
yeah.
And how to do a forward, you know, a forward rate calculation and overall calculating carry, right? So, you know, and it was very much, it was analog in the sense that even though it was on a digital interface, we were doing it like one step at a time. And what's happened is a huge big data batches, the ability to run things, you know, the algos and the systems have been built around. There's just so much data. The hardest part I could tell you in the last 5 years is separating the noise from the data and the signal, I should say, within the data. And that takes, you know, a lot of technology. It requires code, you know, Python, you know, R code, you name it. You throw all that stuff together and you can start to, again, triangulate towards a view. But by and large, I don't think even if you have all the data, you're going to get it always right.
Yeah, it's, I mean, all the data, and again, what is all the data is an interesting question, and how you're, you know, what is the assumption that you're using from a modeling perspective at a starting point? Like, we model things stochastically, so I think that is what I have in common with Green in particular. But how important is it for you, and we'll get into, you know, topics like the Fed and your rates view, how important do you think it is today to have a North Star, a process that gets the direction of long-term interest rates right first?
Oh, that, it's tantamount to everything. It is, like you say, it is the North Star. If you do not understand the path for both long-term and short-term rates, but especially, you know, the belly intermediate rates and what that means for, you know, the corporate sector, for leverage in the system, if you don't understand where that's heading to, you're going to get a lot of sector bets wrong, what you guys do on the equity side. And it's so critical. So I think, and you look at it, if you look at rates, I mean, rates basically, and I'm sure you've done all the cross-market correlations, it's correlated to almost everything that I can see out there. I mean, it's correlated to obviously a lot of the commodity moves that we've had in the last 3 or 6 months. It's, you know, correlated even to like things like uranium, I mean, energy. It's correlated with what's been going on in some of the, you know, of course, utilities. So, I mean, it is, and also just, you know, growth versus, you know, momentum versus, you know, value, all that stuff has been kind of the other side of the rates prism.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, I mean, you know, the highest correlation over the long-term duration, and again, there's a lot of pin action on what I call medium-term trades, 3 weeks or less. You know, there can be plenty of head fakes on a 3-month or less duration. But when you look at the long-term direction of interest rates, the best leading indicator for that is the rate of change of headline inflation. And to me, like, that's why all of those things are doing what they're doing, because they're all the same thing. They're inflating. And, you know, once you start getting down to the screws on uranium versus cattle futures or hogs for that matter, I mean, look, guys, pop up the current CFTC futures and options positioning, which I'm sure George will be aware of. I mean, what you have all of a sudden today is you've got this epic net short position at the short end of the curve, which is unnatural, suffice to say, that, or it wouldn't be a greater than a two standard deviation move on that Z score where I have that green arrow. But underneath, like, once you go to commodities, you're like, oh, and people are along a shitload of pigs and cattle. Yeah, because that stuff's inflating and it's one and the same thing. So I wonder, like, how much of something like that today is based on everybody and their brother and their brother's cat and the cat's dog and whatever else you want to come together. Everybody's talking about inflation all of a sudden, and all of a sudden they're all of the same position. Do you agree with the position that inflation is going to continue to accelerate, and name your duration on that? And B, are you surprised at how quickly the crowd came to us after being nowhere to be found in November?
Well, I mean, you can start from the basic root level of the break-evens on the TIPS market and look at the five-year TIP rate. I mean, it's almost close to negative 2% on a real rate basis.
Yeah.
It's like historic low, and break-evens are look like they want to get towards 3%. I mean, they're 2.6 plus on the five-year break-even. I mean, if you start with that as the anchor, which, you know, ties back to nominal rates with fives and tens in general, I do think that there's a risk here. The risk that I have in once we go beyond the next 6 months is I'm relatively optimistic for the next 6 months. I mean, we're pumping in so much stimulus, and it's hard not to see how this is. And plus, you have the vaccines, you have the reopening of the economy. And to your point, it's the turning, you know, the rate of change and the inflection point that we had in late Q4 to now, that, you know, that has legs and it's going to keep going, you know, into at least May, June, July. Then the question then becomes, and we're also going to see decent, you know, base effects because CPI is going to pump up from the low prints last year. So, you know, it's going to carry into this kind of summer fervor. And then the question is going to be, is it sustainable? And then what's the follow through?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm short term if in my windows, because I know you guys are very much duration based windows. I would say in the next 3 to 6 months, I'm relatively optimistic on the growth and inflation outlook. It's going to keep carrying through. I think we're going to have pit stops along the way. And then, you know, we'll figure it out towards September, October next year, I mean, this year.
So I think you and I are on the same page on that, unfortunately. So we're not going to have any kind of even a fake argument with an Irishman today. But the fact of the matter is that Canadian Irishman, by the way, we're more polite. Until we get in a fight, I guess. but the Fed meeting today, you know, like, there's what you and I think, and then there's what the Fed thinks, and then there's what the Fed really thinks, and then there's what the Fed's, you know, the guys that pay the, you know, got the guys in the seats at the Fed want them to think. So, like, can you get into that game a little bit in terms of what we're going to hear or what you think we're going to hear today, and moreover, what we've been hearing and what the pattern here is?
Yeah, so I mean, like, maybe if we want to turn to page, I think, 6 on the PowerPoint.
Yep, it's got it. Yep,
we got it. Some are saying that today is the most important day of the year. I argue every day is the most important day of the year.
As long as
it
is.
As long as you're alive and kicking, you can always kind of regroup. But all joking aside, I mean, it is a big important Fed day because they've kind of missed the opportunity to fix a couple of, like, very wonky mechanical things they could have actually addressed, which sometimes, you know, begs, you know, the question, like, what are they thinking if they don't realize if markets are focused on a topic, even if they think it's the wrong topic, they need to address it. And I think that they will address it. And that is this whole idea about the supplementary leverage ratio. Is it really that much of an issue for banks? You know, a lot of people have been debating that, including myself. But, you know, I do think that this is their opportunity to fix that. It's been one of the reasons that many folks in the bond markets have been suggesting has been driving up the rise in rates, that who's going to hold all these, you know, reserves and more importantly, the treasuries as we keep expanding our deficits. So what they do around the SLR is going to be interesting.
So just so the people, because I'm telling you right now, some people are like, what the hell is supplementary leverage ratio? That's SLR. You said it twice, but I said it for the third time. Like, why is it that thing?
Well, it's basically capital that has to be put against overall positions on a bank balance sheet, which for some reason treasuries and cash were still included. So I really think deep down inside, the Fed doesn't agree with this policy, but it came from Basel. It came all the way back. It goes back to just this kind of a global coordination amongst regulators. And I think that, truth be told, that if the Fed wants to buy time, it's an easy win to them to just say, we're going to extend it for 6 more months, solicit more feedback from the banks, and then try to figure out, like, how can we do a carve out on cash? Like, why are you reserving capital against cash? It makes no sense. I mean, it's liquidity, right? But this is what happens when you have so much, you know, interwoven regulations from around the world intersecting with each other. And long story short, I don't want to bore your audience, but it's a topic that the bond market's focused on. It's been one of the reasons why rates have been rising. I kind of agree with that view too. So if they can nip that in the bud quickly, that would at least stabilize rates from just kind of going unhinged. There was a meeting yesterday. The Fed doesn't have to address every single meeting that they do other than ones that are publicly announced. But there was according to their website, a meeting, which means more than two people coming together. And it's possible that they, the board, which makes the decisions on the SLR, they could have met yesterday. And now they're, as a kind of to get ahead of the FOMC meeting. And what I think they should do is release a press release at the same time as the FOMC statement and say, look, you know, we're going to look to deal with the SLR problem down the road. We don't want to be, you know, binding on March 31st, you know, 2 weeks away. So let's just kind of nip that in the bud, yep. Focus on the macro. And on the macro side, they have that's really even a bigger problem for them, because the bond market is toying with the Fed right now. They're like, look, we're pricing in 3 hikes in 2023. And you told us you're going to stay on hold for, you know, till 2024. Like, who's going to win that game of, you know, of stare down? I think the Fed could gingerly walk this one back by not marking to market on their rate expectations. I mean, for the last 10 plus years, when they started giving these things called the dots, which is their forecast for rates, yep. They've kind of sometimes chased the market. But I argue, and maybe I'm going to be wrong, but we'll see. Last year, they changed their framework around inflation. They wanted to run hot. Okay, well, if you wanted to run hot, don't. Even if inflation is starting to run hot, don't start to price in hikes along with the market, because then you're going to end up like the Bank of Japan and you're going to lose credibility around actually achieving your inflation target. So I think that they're going to keep the dots pretty much the same. They're going to upgrade their growth and inflation forecasts and try to be as dovish as possible, because, Keith, it's March. Like, I hope the U.S. economy is growing at 6-8% by September. But what if it isn't? If the Fed makes this policy error so early in the year, they're going to have to play catch up all throughout the year. So there's no reason to do anything drastic today other than be as dovish as they usually are, maybe up the ante, fix this SLR, and then hope for the best. I mean, look at what happened in January. The S&P was down 2.6% on the Fed day. That was the fourth, I think, largest decline since the 1970s. And like, Powell basically didn't do anything wrong. He just kind of delivered the message. So I think that, you know, they're going to try to be as clinical as possible, just like stick to the script and then like get off the stage.
Just like a good lawyer should. I mean, like I said, it has a lot to do with, you know, I call him P.E. Powell because, you know, that he worked at Carlisle, I worked at Carlisle, whatever. We know where he made his $100 million. And again, he does serve his master. Like, you know, dislocating, you know, high yield spreads or something for real that would really bother private equity is much more of a concern than an S&P 500 down day. But my perspective on what you just said is, if in fact they don't do what you did, and they were to make a policy mistake like he did, you know, when he was a rookie in the seat in Q4 of 2018, then the forward outlook becomes rate cuts, not rate hikes.
That's right. No, it's a delicate dance, 100%. So, and I think they get that. So, like, your initial question was like multi-layered, like what do we think they should do versus what they will do?
Yeah.
I think they've kind of learned it the hard way. They've been acting indifferent that rates have been rising, and that's like all fine and good. I mean, rates will continue to rise as long as they can calibrate the message right and the economy is, you know, really reopening. But why shoot themselves in the foot at this point early on in the year?
Yeah, I don't think that that's in the cards. I mean, at the end of the day, on the inflation point, running hot, just to keep this, you know, and again, I do appreciate, and I wanted you on for this specific reason, to explain the plumbing, explain some of these acronyms that people talk about, but they don't explain it in English. But the real English is, I want to let inflation run hot. I want, you know, all you fire engine chasers who are chasing inflation, I want that dog to catch the truck. Like, that to me is going to change in terms of like the narrative in the next, quite literally the next, if our model's right, guys, pop up slide 15. Like, we're going to have a three handle on quarterly inflation, never mind some monthly prints. And yeah, I think he started to explain, because I know some of his friends or some of my clients are telling him, hey, talk about the base effects. You know, those words have started to come out of his mouth, right? Because he wants to, he's already starting to play defense against what is the, it's not just the dog chasing the truck, it's on the fireman's ass. It's in the truck. Like, when you're at 3%, and as you know, to get a quarterly number, 3.02 includes a higher number than 3 on one of the monthlies, he's going to have to defend that, or not. Like, how do you think that that's going to be messaged around, and will the bond market really care? Because my point has been all along, if you get inflation right, I'm going to get the long end of the curve right anyway. The long end doesn't care so much about what the Fed's saying. It cares about what the inflation numbers are doing, most importantly, where they're going towards.
So look, so this is, again, like, this is March. They have a meeting in between June, which is the next forecast update. They look, this is their time. I mean, they mentioned they want to run hot, and they also mentioned that they want to be basically credibly irresponsible. They want to be they want to make up for all this lost time that they were running inflation sub 2 for the last decade after pumping in all these trillions of QE. They know that it's a confidence game. At the end of the day, you know, we're seeing confidence around the consumer that inflation is going to get higher, which is what they really focus on. I mean, the bond market's already given them that signal through break evens. You're starting to get some of the small business, NFIB of, numbers coming through that there's price pressures. So, like, there's going to be inflation. And then now they have to embrace it, because if they start to, like, fight it this early on, then they're not going to really get it. So it's going to be this delicate dance. And I think that, you know, they can address that May, June into the summer if they want to. And we can discuss that more towards the end of our conversation around, like, how do they taper? How do they actually dial it back? Because this is going to be so complicated. But For today's business, it's about stay dovish. We're still in the pandemic. Let's get inflation up there, even though we know base effects. We can try to talk away some of that. But then, you know, let's talk again in June.
See, to me, that's why bond yields are going higher again this morning, and shocking people who told the bond market to stop doing that. You know, it's kind of, and again, it's like equity people or whatever, CNBC people saying, well, that's it. You know, I think that the 10-year is done going up. Well, thanks, you know. And I think that I'm Irish. I mean, that's you know, revelations of the blazingly obvious. So, I mean, to me, it's, again, if you get the numbers right. I mean, guys, pop up slide 75 in my deck. I mean, these numbers, as you know, George, I mean, the rate of change of these numbers, and this is opinions, right? This is a diffusion index, obviously, which is ISM prices paid in the ISM aggregate survey. Yeah, those numbers don't go up at that pace ever. And now, basically, those are going to go off the chart, like right off the chart. So to me, the pace of gains in the bond market on the long end of the curve reflect a lot of these numbers, and that's on a diffusion index. You look at hard data like retail sales or consumption expectations type data, consumer confidence fully loaded. You know, there's really no scope for them to say, you know, anything other than what you said, which is like, hey, look, we're dovish. The numbers are hawkish, but we're dovish.
And look, I mean, the plumbing thing, maybe if I can pull up one thing, because I think it's important for equity folks to focus on, not that all your clients are equity folks, but you know, page 10 is one of my favorite charts, the slide 10.
Yep.
And so what I'm showing you here, the other issue that the Fed's confronting with is that the U.S. government is now going to use all of this kind of cash hoard that they saved through this thing called the Treasury General Account, which we call the TGA. They had over trillion and a half, and started to come down very quickly as they start cutting out the checks and money starts flowing through post the passage of the Biden stimulus plan. What I'm showing you here is the reserve growth, which is in black, and then the blue line is the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index, which captures, you know, high yield spreads and equities and so a lot of other factors in there.
Right.
But I always found this chart very interesting, that there's a decent correlation. People always wonder, how does QE actually kind of work its way through into financial assets? Well, one of them is just through the confidence channel, but the other one is through overall liquidity and the ability to and a portfolio rebalancing channel, which rates are still relatively low, and the Fed is buying a lot of the paper that someone else would have had to purchase. So the point of this chart is really to say that, if you look at the little gray bar towards the right side of the chart, which is the projections going forward, the reserve growth is on pace to really surpass last year's reserve growth.
Yeah, big time.
And it's another one of those things that it's going off the charts, just like inflation is going off the charts. There's going to be so much liquidity that it probably ends up creating the melt up that a lot of people are talking about between March and the summer. You have this big surge of liquidity that's going to come in. Now the question the Fed has to address, maybe not today, but over the next two meetings, do they start draining some of those reserves and encouraging a slowdown of that? Because otherwise you're going to get a Y2K on steroids.
Well, they're not going to. I mean, anything could happen. So you're saying there's a chance that they could say that. But the fact of the matter is that the high probability event is dovish. Dovish with the next chart that you have is even more eye-popping, which is the TGA flood to $5 trillion chart. I think that's on slide 11. It's like, why do you even have a time series? You just don't. It doesn't matter where you used to be or where you could have gone from a mean reversion perspective. It's off the chart.
And it doesn't come back.
It's okay. Yeah.
They tried with the quantitative tightening, right? They actually had an honest attempt. Like, of all the central banks, we have to give it to like two. Bank of Japan in 2000, 2001, 2006, we unwound all their QE. But then they came back with a vengeance. And the Fed tried to unwind QE just a little bit, and then they had to do 3x what they did before. So it's like, they're now wedded to this liquidity management aspect of it. And that's all fine and good. But the question is, what's like the hangover effect? Like, what's the cliff effect on the other side?
Oh, my God. I mean, well, actually, tell me if you think this is fair. The other side, if it's bad, is more of that. It's the only way you fix the other side is to do more of what you just did. It's the definition of insanity.
It is. However, I'm not sure if you had a chance to flip through. Maybe we can bounce around the deck because I think we're in the fluid motion. If we go to let me see what slide that is. It is slide 19.
Okay.
So one thing I've been trying to reconcile and see if there is a limit to QE. I mean, like, how far can they go? And this is why you're starting to hear in many channels the idea of central bank digital currencies and directly injecting money into people's wallets or into their bank accounts, whatever method they choose to use. But what I'm showing you here is the percentage of cash on bank balance sheets in Japan and in Switzerland, which are also notorious huge QEers. They are massive on the QE front. And then I'm showing the Fed's experience, which is the orange line, which is looking at a slightly derivation of that, which is cash versus total bank deposits. In QE3, that got close to almost 30%.
Oh my God!
And I think what the Fed ended up realizing is that back then, remember in 2013, 14 before the taper, they're like, oh, it's QE infinity. Okay, well, if it's QE infinity, at some point you consume the host. Like, you just, there's going to be so much cash sitting at the banks that they have to grow into that cash, start to lend it. They can't just like, so they're in a really, I think we're going to get to a point. That's why that $5 trillion number puts them close to 25%. And if it keeps going higher, basically you're going to really start to dilute, return on equity for banks. I mean, you're going to, not that they care about, return on equity for banks, but you're stuffing them with a lot of cash.
Yeah.
As a response of all this deposit growth, because, people are selling their treasuries to the Fed.
Well, that's, losing. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why the banks are like, screw it. I can't drive ROI. I just got to buy shit. They're just going to take the cash and buy companies, or they're going to try to reconstitute what it is that they're able to do and do more of that. I mean, that is an amazing. I have not looked at it that way. That is that's mind numbing, really. I mean, so still, I don't see like a person. Let's say that we hit, say your roadmap and mine's pretty close. I mean, you said 3 to 6 months. I'm like, 6 months ago, I said 3 to 6 months, and now I'll say 3 months. But I mean, from here, if you achieve these peak kind of inflation, and I do think that they'll be like on the headlines, I've already showed you a couple that are freaky, ISM prices paid in particular. You're going to, you end up with these types of inflation numbers and these, the horse already leaving the barn on that, on the copper looking colored copper or orange line on slide 19. It's all in motion. And the minute that you stop it or hint that you're going to stop it, the only solution for it is to do more of it. I mean, I can't get past that last point.
I know. And look, I'm struggling with that too. And I've been brainstorming, like, what could they do? Like, what options do they have? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, they end up renaming things, but it's the same thing, right?
It's cash. It's printing money. I mean, that, I don't know.
So, I mean, I think that, look, deep down inside, in the past, they tried to soft land the economy. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to try to soft land the markets.
Exactly. Big difference.
And it's a big difference because, I mean, the fiscal side can probably keep us going, but we all know that if there's a 30-40% correction in risk assets, it's going to change the mood and behavior on the street in a heartbeat.
Big time.
So I mean, what they could do is do some version of a twisting and tapering. And I know this is very technical, and I don't think they're going to announce it anytime soon, but I'm just thinking about, they have all these short-term treasuries that are sitting on their bank on their portfolio, and the market actually is clamoring for short-term collateral all the time. So why don't you give the market what they want? Give them short-term treasuries that you own that really doesn't move the needle on compressing, you know, credit spreads or term premium on the curve. Why don't you do a minor twist, but you do it in tandem with as you're tapering. So right now they're putting in $80 billion new money every single month by treasury purchases. They can do something like by the start of next year where, you know, as they wind down the new money, they start selling some of the short-term treasuries and use that money to torque down the long-term rates in case things get out of control. If the Biden administration launches a $4 trillion infrastructure plan, someone's going to have to buy all those long-term treasuries. So I think that there's going to be this kind of twist taper arrangement that will be announced late in the year, which will let them as gracefully as possible try to exit. And they have to do that because, remember, all those $80 billion per month, it's almost $1 trillion a year, in addition to that TGA flood that I showed you before, like $5-7 trillion of reserves in the banking system is stifling. So if they can do like a reserve neutral quantitative easing, that to me, I think, is going to be the innovation of the Fed in the next 6 months.
That's really interesting because it's really, you show this on slide 20, actually, the 2011 twist, which when people ask me, when's the last time, or what are your mistakes? People love that question, right? I mean, I royally screwed up in the middle of 2011 because I had no idea that Bernanke could do exactly what you just called it, or he called it. He calls it financial innovation, when he twisted the curve. It's not easy for people to. I don't think it's easier for people to understand.
No, look, I mean, and that was by the way an upgrade to the 1960s twist. So the U.S. has been twisting for a long time whenever they need to.
Yeah,
and they could do that. So I think twist is within the cards. It solves a lot of issues, but they can't do cold turkey. What we know, I guess, to answer your question, they can't do cliff. They can't let go, we're doing 80, and then we're going to slowly get out of this and give you nothing for the next 3-5 years, given all the deficits that we have. I highly doubt it. So I think they're going to do some sort of elegant solution like this.
That's they would call that, you're using the, you might, you might appeal to these guys. It's elegant. It's innovative. Some people are watching this like, this is freaking crazy. Like, this is nuts. People go nuts about this stuff. I'm going to have Snyder on, who's like plumbing 101 guy. And he's going to lose his shit on this stuff, man.
Oh, no, he totally will. And listen, I actually, you guys pulled together the slide. I didn't have anything to do with it. So when I looked at it and I was like, I wonder if any Fed people are going to read it and see, George and Kyle was the Fed BS detector. The BS detector has been something that I've gotten a lot of flank on Twitter because I'm always updating the Fed's balance sheet every week just for fun.
Yeah. No, just for fun. That's just what George does for fun. I mean, I got to go to the Q&A. I mean, by the way, I'm going to take the first question before I take the – keep sending in your questions. They'll get upvoted and I'll ask those. My question is actually on slide 22 because I really think you do a good job here, thinking through – the bridge, the MMT bridge, how we get the big, as Pelosi called it this week, this big, bold, and tremendously phenomenal. She might as well have just used, she should have had Trump market it with her with the words. But again, this is interesting. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so, earlier in the year, or last year, the U.S. Brought back the New Kids on the Block hit, which was the 20-year.
Yep.
And the 20-year security now is growing in size as a proportion of overall debt that the U.S. is issuing. But as you can see, the skew or the overall issuance of U.S. government debt is primarily short-term securities. You know, if they're going to do an infrastructure plan, you cannot finance it with short-term treasuries. You need to start to pump up the long-term sector. And this is why I feel like it goes hand in hand with that
twist.
There's going to be a fiscal kind of coordination with the Fed in order to get this done.
Yeah, that's I mean, when you really play it through the way you have, you mean you're telling the story that they're trying to get to. The problem with their story, it's a chapter book. It comes, you know, there. It's a chapter book that has prior books, 1960s twist, 2011 twist. We're going to do this, but the problem with the book is that the book goes in linear time, according to them, and the market goes in clock time. So they're like, that's the friction, is how the hell, and client after client always wants to know where are they going and why. And I think that, you know, even if you do know the answer, let's say that you're plugged in from the private equity side and you actually know what he's going to do. Because people know, you still would probably screw up trading it.
Well, listen, I mean, even if I get this all right, let's say that my view is right, and they end up doing, in between now and then, you know, the 20-year can still sell off a lot, and so it exactly. might be the right trade, you know, down the line.
Yeah. All right. First question, of course, it's a bond guy from Montana, Bill from Montana. Do you see, George, do you see alternating periods of stagflation and deflation playing out over the next decade? This is an interesting question to be voted number one because all we've talked about is inflation.
Well, that goes back to like my kind of short-term, medium-term, long-term outlook. And, you know, 3-6 months, who knows, right? Because it's all fluid depending on all the information that we get. But we should still see higher inflation prints, and that could naturally, you know, just push up rates towards 2% on the 10-year. Much more than that, I just don't see happening. If you guys go back to think slide 13, just to kind of help answer this question.
Yep.
This is the long-term bond bull cycle, right? Which, you know, you could really even go back to the 1970s, but the early 80s was kind of still volatile. But you know, post 1987 stock market crash and after kind of a big kind of decline in rates that started in the late 80s, early 90s. We've been in this long-term downward channel, right? And we've seen many attempts in the past for the inflation story to take off. That here it comes. You know, we're gonna get this massive inflation. It's gonna break this channel, and we're gonna go back to the world the way things were back in the 70s. The difference, really, to me, is that A, we have never done that before. B, the only time that the rates actually try to flirt with the upper band of this cycle is when the Fed is physically hiking. And the Fed is not hiking anytime soon. So, and there's also this natural kind of feedback loop that the higher rates go, because we are a leveraged society and a leveraged system, it becomes deflationary nature later on. So in this next 3 to 6 months, I mean, it's fair game that I think that there's going to be enough fodder for both inflationists and deflationists to fight it out and duke it out. But then as we get into the second half, into the early part of next year, what's the fiscal cliff? How well does the Fed manage this? What I described sounds, elegant or simple to do. It's not. And there's going to be a lot of volatility potentially at that point.
Yeah, I think that is, and it should have been Exhibit A before we even started talking about bonds. I mean, because, again, you have a lot of people fully loaded with gold bugs, anyone who's long a deflation or duration portfolio. The people that are famous, Lacey Hunt, obviously, a lot of great, research people on Wall Street that have stayed with that longer term, debt creates deflationary pressure view. And that's what that tells you, that it's cyclical. Inflation's cyclical, but deflation has been secular. And that's been, that's been the case. So if you're going to continue to try to solve the problem with more and more debt, then you're going to continue to revisit the deflationary lows. And I believe that. I mean, I'm in this for the next, maybe 3 months, after being in it since November. But I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know. I'm going to have to wake up with 2 feet, God willing, on the floor and get at it every day to try to measure and map that. This question here, from Sarah Marie, she's from France. Do you see a bout of consolidation, like in the shorter term, which is, I think it's always important to think multi-duration. Do you see a bout of consolidation in the near term with yields dropping? I think she's talking about the 10-year towards 1.2 before resuming a rally, north of 2.
So I do believe it's going to be a multi-stage sort of sell-off. I mean, look, the rate of change, which I know you guys live in and die by it, it's been about 70 basis points since the last Fed hike, and it's been one of the fastest kind of 2 or 3 month windows. It's pretty quick, the move in the 10-year. If the Fed is super dovish and delivers some of the things that I mentioned, and given how stretched we are in a number of metrics, and I get it that they can stay stretched for longer than you can stay solvent, and that's fine. But I do think we are due a consolidation, and it, maybe it's not worth 50 basis points, but, you know, 25 plus, and then we're going to, you know, consolidate and then figure out, you know, from a 140, 135 level, which was the prior lows and a lot of the other rallies that we've had in the last 10 years, from that point forward, if the inflation kicks in, which it should, you know, to your point, you know, we're going to see it for the base effects and a lot of other reasons, that should carry us close to 190, 185 is where I'm at.
Yeah, that I'm actually at 192. That, you know, it's the ongoing question. Like I was one and done, you know, on my invite to New York to present to the New York Fed on how that works, like how the step ups. What I was trying to say is, hey, look, I use a risk range process. So currently, I can't get the 10-year yield much below 1.45. So because people do think in 25 basis point increments, that's a linear way to think. I mean, the fact of the matter is that this is a nonlinear system, and there are, you know, plenty of emergent properties in the system, if you think fractally, that actually drive the numbers to numbers that people on Wall Street just wouldn't use. I mean, like, I'm using 192. I mean, what's 192? It's not 2. And every question is going to be about round numbers. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it is important to be as sharp as you are with specificity and timing on that. This next question is really interesting. I don't know if you made a call on this or not, but, you know, I'm kind of interested because these are my shorts, you know, in terms of ETFs. Hi, George. How low does the zeros, ZROZ, which has been awesome on the short side, and TLT go before you want to re-enter for some ballast in the portfolio?
Well, so, I mean, look, those are high duration vehicles, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
So they're not the same thing as, like, you know, looking at people sometimes. I mean, again, this is part of just good old bond math 101, that the duration and the yield kind of relationship based on maturity is a big deal. And those are long duration assets. So you have to, you know, and they trade almost like equities in many ways. But from like a flip side point of view, I think they're close. I mean, but again, that's so like the pain threshold for the Fed is not so much like the 30-year Treasury. It's much more the 5-year and 10-year sector, which is tied to, you know, consumer rates, auto rates, and things like that. And so, you know, they're going to be watching more what's happening in 5-year and 10-year. If the 30-year can also stabilize in this, you know, near-term correction that I think we might get, it's more of a trade than an actual strong buying level, because I do think that, you know, 30s will get caught up with the inflation buzz in the next couple months too.
Last question. This one's a good one, and take your time with it if you have thoughts. I mean, I worry about this a lot. You know, both my parents are, you know, pensioners. I mean, what happens? First of all, let's start with what is happening to the pensioner with the 60-40 portfolio. Let's say that they're allocated based on their age to duration, which is a joke. What is happening to them? They're not having the year that those who are long of GameStop are. Let's be clear on that. And what happens to them at the pivot this year, if you and I are right, and this is within the construct of that long-term bond yield chart, this is going to be a local high to be faded.
Well, you know, that's a big question. There's a lot. It's very loaded, right? Let's break it down, right? I mean, if you're already in that 60-40 portfolio, and I agree with you, you need to really change your asset allocation model in a way where you're not just you know, age-based doesn't make any sense to me either, especially because I could be wrong. You, Keith, you and I could be both wrong that somehow this inflation expectation, you know, energy that's out there actually, you know, takes hold, and, you know, it doesn't stop at 192 and it goes to 3. I don't know. I mean, at that point, it starts to cause so much pain that, you know, like, the question is, do you build cash in order to, like, average it as high as you can possibly, right? Because on the flip side, on the other side of that trade will probably rally back at least 100, and that's, you know, that's some big total return points right there. So, but because there's, again, we're in this kind of tug of war between the inflationists and deflationists, you know, you're not going to know it until you actually fought that battle, and I think we're in the middle of it. So I would say, you know, if you're in it already, I mean, if you haven't scaled back on your bonds now, it'd be kind of foolish to do it now, because you might want to scale back some of the longer duration stuff like the TLT and the zeros that were mentioned in the other question. But you need to have some fixed income exposure, because you're not going to nail it. You won't be able to get the inflection point perfectly if that's the way you operate, which you shouldn't be, because 60-40 is too rigid.
Yeah, it's always the hardest question to answer, because you're trying to fix a mistake that you can't undo. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that in October, November, you had an opportunity to sell duration. You know, that's why we made it theme one of the top three macro themes at Hedgeye. You know, so again, it's like that. There are certain points in the bond market to make asset allocation decisions, either getting out or getting back in. And the fact of the matter is the horse has left the barn here. So it's a real tough one. And I still think that that window, for whatever it's worth, people, you know, people try to time these windows. If the Fed thinks for whatever reason that that window, just because it's due to base effects in short term, that window is still one that many people, like with their hard-earned, you know, their hard-earned net worth, they're going to fall out of the window. Yeah. And I don't know what else to say. It's just kind of sad. I didn't mean to end this on a sad note, George, but I mean, it was a very...
A lot of people, we're a little more gloomy in general, right? So it's apropos.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe people are already starting to drink because they didn't have to, you know, keep their eyes on the prize here with all your great research and the content. I think you really brought something that is kind of boring to a lot of people, bonds, and you brought it to life, and you did a great job of that. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Keith. It was a pleasure.
Awesome. He's George. Now, you can find him on Twitter, The Bond Strategist, and you can find me. I'll be back here, and I will not. I promise you. Cross my heart. I will not drink in the intermission. We'll be back with the European, Daniel Lacaille.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.